Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 187, Drawing the Rabbit in the Moon.
I guess, hello there, some people are out there online. Cozily in bed, snuggled up on a cold night, watching on the thing, and the great thing is they can just turn me off at any time they want. That's you guys are, poor guys are captive. But, so that's nice to do that. And we're doing that because His Holiness asked us to teach more. He said, it's nice having art on the walls and showing Tibetan culture that way, but, you know, the main essence of Tibetan culture is the teaching. And so we're trying to do that. So the thing about Shakyamuni that we will see today, looking at this, these discourses, as I translate the word sutra, I think scripture is the wrong word for it. Sutra, discourse is the real word. He is secularizing it. He is a rebel against religion, completely. And you'll see it here. You know, the Brahmins and the Vedic religion and the whole thing, he's totally rebelling against it. And he's not founding a religion at all. He is changing people's psyche. He's giving them some tools with which to work on their understanding. And he has no intention of founding like a new Veda, so to speak, you know, where you believe something. So the way we define religion today is belief system, right? And that's sort of anthropological. And sometimes, like Clifford Geertz or some social scientists will say, and a system of ritual behaviors that go along with the belief system. So it's like, you know, when I was in college, I studied with Talcott Parsons, famous sociologist, and he had this a great set of concepts which he called different ideas. There were two kinds, pattern maintaining and pattern transcending. And he wasn't particularly referring to religion, although you can apply that to religion too. And mostly, but social scientists and mostly the way religious studies scholars, like in my department, the way they define religion is mainly the pattern maintaining sort of thing. And you can even see in the word dharma, you know the Sanskrit word dharma, dharma, which has Vasubandhu in the 4th century or early 5th century gives 11 meanings in Sanskrit for dharma. And there's a line in the 11 in the middle, or a little maybe up two-thirds up, where it goes from pattern maintaining to pattern transcending in a Parsonian sort of way, if you understand, if you follow me. And therefore, you often find Buddhist translators wrongly translating dharma when they're talking about Buddha dharma, Buddha's dharma. They call it the law of the good white lotus. They translate the word law. And dharma in Hindi today does mean law, actually. And that was one of the meanings in Buddha's time. Dharma was law. Dharma shastra in Sanskrit literature means the law treatise. But Buddha redefined it. Why does it become pattern maintaining sort of thing? Because it comes from the verb dhir, which means to hold. So it means holding your behavior and your mind in a certain pattern. So law, duty, religion, custom, it has that range of pattern maintaining meanings. Now Buddha changed the meaning and added to those meanings teaching, which he meant critical thinking to break away from conventions and to understand their nature of reality, path that you travel by practicing that teaching, and the goal of the teaching, which is the reality of nirvana. So the highest meaning of dharma means reality or nirvana. And then he took the etymology of the verb to hold by saying that what his dharma does is hold you in freedom from suffering. So it's the opposite, in a way, from the old pattern maintaining thing. It's totally pattern transcending, if you follow me. And therefore, it's not a religion in the way religion is defined and people go secular. You know, the Buddha, you'll see in the sutras, or if you read them, you already know, and I will point out points in these sutras, where he's completely criticizing the existing religion of the Vedic Brahmins of his time. And even the religion of the Shramanic yogis, the seeker yogis, he's criticizing that that as well, you know, in a certain way. And the rebirth business and all this karma and all of that, he's also changing karma. Karma also meant, before Buddha's time, and he may not be uniquely credited with the change of meaning of karma, but karma meant, in the Vedic sense, ritual action. A karma was an action you did in a ritual because the Vedic people believed the gods controlled your fate and they controlled the world. And so you had to appease them and get them to do nice things for you and shape the world in a good way through by commissioning some priest to do a ritual for you. And then that ritual affected your destiny. So karma got to mean a kind of action that changed your and shaped your existence. But the Buddha completely changed that, and he said, this ritual, the gods, they can't take care of themselves. He didn't deny their existence. He just said there's no one all-powerful God. And the gods are powerful, but often they cause trouble. They have fights with each other. They have marital disputes and things, like the Olympian gods in Greece. So they're not enlightened, and they can't save you from suffering. And so rituals appeasing them could have a worldly purpose, but it's not going to save you from suffering. So the only way you're going to be saved from suffering is understanding the nature of reality. And if you do, then you will be free of suffering when you fully understand it. So in a way, the thesis of this book and why I was so excited in the Course for Good, and making a course through it or connected to it, is that His Holiness the Dalai Lama, in my opinion, and that's my thesis in this course, is doing the same thing of trying to help beings come to a better understanding of themselves and their world, and therefore better behavior in interacting with each other in the world, according to the science of the day, according to the secular humanist reality of the times. And therefore, because people are, you know, have an automatic reaction when they hear about rebirth, they think that's a religious thing, and nobody, you know, there's no rational proof, it's not a scientific finding, although that's wrong. I argue that that's wrong, as I will. But most people just have a knee-jerk thing, oh, okay, that's some sort of superstitious religious thing, because the consensual materialist reality doesn't get into it. And so he brackets that. He brackets even nirvana, and he talks compassion, and he talks mindfulness, and he talks this kind of thing, which is just what Shakyamuni does in a different setting, and actually possibly in a more evolved cultural setting, actually, rather than ours. Although we think of ourselves moderns as so wonderfully evolved. But actually, there is such a thing. You know, there's being civilized and there's being savage. So there's primitive civilizedness, pre-modern, that is to say, civilizedness, and pre-modern savagery. And then as we see more and more in our world today, or if we lived last century through the middle, we would see there's industrial civilizedness, maybe, or as Gandhi said to Churchill once, that at least would be a good idea. And there is industrial savagery, for sure. And so we may be a little bit, you know, not so advanced as we think, anyway. Okay? So the force for good, I'm saying, is a secular, humanistic, civilizing force. If Shakyamuni were to incarnate in this time, he would be the Dalai Lama, basically. That's about the best he could do, I think. And then he was in a society that had become somewhat stagnant, although by no means was it diabolical and hell and feudal and slavery and all this crap that Chinese propaganda says, but they were kind of jolly and happy in their funkiness, the Tibetans, and they were free. You know, they were nomads going around in the most amazing, look at this place, look at that. They were like in the sky there, you know. And they, you know, they didn't have flush toilets. Gee whiz, you know. They returned the crap right to the soil, you know, it helped grow more grass for the yaks. And the yaks kept the prairies and the pastures beautifully green like that, at very high altitude. Because the yaks are browsers. They browse, and they don't graze. Did you know that? Yaks do not graze like cows, or goats, or sheep, they browse. And that's an agricultural term, and it means that they lick the blade of grass off the root and don't bite it, so it doesn't disturb the root. They have a very sandpaper. If you ever meet a pet yak, do not accept slurps. Slurping kisses is like sandpaper. Very rough tongues. Okay, so with that preface, and now I want to announce, next week, Elizabeth Pijov, very kindly, who is also teaching a lot of great compassion courses here this year and in the future. We're delighted to have her. She is going to carry the class on the compassion training as a special thing in the course because she is trained at a compassion program from Stanford, which was set up by Dalai Lama's translator and Jim Doty, a friend of ours, a surgeon there named Jim Doty. And so she is doing the Dalai Lama's Course for Good. She's like an agent of the Dalai Lama's Course for Good and has been teaching here, which is our good, and at Columbia, actually, to students. So I asked her to be part of that, you know. And I don't know exactly what sources, Buddhist sources, she will do, but I'm considering that week to be connected as being connected to compassion. The underlying thing will be some Jataka tales, the former lives of the Buddha, the first sort of Disney Lassie stories in world history, which were the Jataka tales. And Buddha was, when he was a former life, he was Lassie, you know, and he went and saved people from the burning hut or whatever, and did different things like that. And he was the Bodhisattva monkey, and he was the whatever, you know, different animals, they're more of a thing. So on the sides, Course for Good is always on the reading list, but on the reading list for that, which will be online, will be some Jataka tales. But I haven't put them there yet, but I will scan and put some Jataka tales there. I think I have some scans. And particularly, I'm very fond of the ones where he gives himself to people and beings out of compassion and generosity. And as I said, really like animal stories that illustrate moral tales of selflessness and compassion and wisdom and things like that. Wonderful one, just to tell one sort of a little bit in the line of preparing for next week. Wonderful one where he's the king of the deer in Benares, and he's a magnificent, amazing, huge deer with antlers and everything. And he makes a deal with the king of Benares that they should only take one deer a day and not just go out and massively hunt the herds of his deer. And then he has a thing with his own group that one person volunteers and gives their life, you know, per day, so that they don't come and shoot 30 or 40 for the day, you know. And then there's a pregnant doe in his herd who says, I'll be happy to take my turn. It came to her turn. But she says, I should really wait and give birth, and then when the fawn is okay, then I'll go, and I'll, you know, somebody should switch turns with me. And nobody would switch turns with her. So he comes to know this, the king. And he says, okay, I'll switch turns with you. I set up this deal. I'll go. And he goes to the royal kitchen of the king of Benares. And the cook is a little freaked because it's not the usual deer, you know, the usual venison dinner. It's like this magnificent big deer who talks. And he says, I'm here today. You know, this is my turn. Well, you're not supposed to be here. You're the king. He said, yeah, but I'm here. I'm taking the turn today, he says. So then the cook doesn't really, like, chop him up right away. He runs up to the king and he says, Your Majesty, there's like a deer here might be a little too extra special for today's lunch. Would you come and check it out? I don't know what to do. And so the king comes down, and then they have a conversation. And then the king says, you deer are better than us humans. Here you're going to give your life for a humble citizen of your herd. And look at me. So then they proclaim the thing where they went vegetarian in Benares, in that Jataka tale. So he didn't actually die in that case. Sometimes he does give his life in those Jataka tales as a different kind of animal. Then there's the second one. There's the Buddha who in his former life was a rabbit. And as a rabbit, and I'm sorry, I forget some of the detail of that, as a rabbit, he made a competition with some other animals about helping a starving traveler in the forest. And they, one of the animals sort of gave him, brought him some water, and one of the animals brought him some twigs to make a fire, and another one some stone that he could make a spark and a fire and all this. And then, but then nobody really came up with food that he could much eat, so then the rabbit came and jumped into the fire and fed him with rabbit burger, you know, like stewed rabbit or whatever it was, fried rabbit. So then the starving traveler turned out to be Indra, the king of the semi-mundane gods, the Olympian gods, an Indian version of the Olympian gods. And Indra said, this rabbit is so great, giving himself to others so unselfishly. And he drew the rabbit in the moon. So in Buddhist cultures, and there isn't, when I grew up, I thought there was a grumpy old man in the room holding up a lantern. And I wasn't sophisticated enough to realize that probably he was looking to see if anybody was being naughty. But I'm sure that was the implication for me as a child. But when a Buddhist looks at the moon because of that tail, they see a bodhisattva rabbit who's wanting to feed himself to a starving traveler, which may be bad for their vegetarianism, but it's kind of cute, you know, that they're drawn by the god. So anyway, that's enough on that. And these stories that Buddha tells of his previous lives are really marvelous, and so I will put some of them up for you to read. But today we're talking about the Buddha's life as his teaching. You know, like one of my life ambitions is to make a film or a play about the life of the Buddha. Actually, a film, really, but then there's some movement toward a play. And previous movies made about the Buddha, with the exception of one Japanese one, have been very unsuccessful, because they only concern his youth and his enlightenment, and then he leaves town. Then they sort of people suppose he teaches, and then he attains parinirvana, which they wrongly think means he leaves the universe, which of course he doesn't. And pari doesn't mean final, as they translate it. Pari means thorough. So he just becomes not visible in a coarse body, but present all throughout time and space, actually, like joining all the infinite other numbers of Buddha. So they leave out the teaching, but the most interesting part of Buddha's life is his tangling with his society once he is enlightened. You know, by their fruits ye shall know them, you know, by the acts ye shall know them. You know, the way he deals with people and things, that's really where we come to see the Buddha in action. That's really what's interesting. And that's what we're doing here. There's two we're going to do first. We're going to do the first three, actually, which are the Brahmajala, I'm going through a little bit, and then my favorite one, the Fruits of the Homeless Life, what he calls, or the Samanapala Sutta, and then maybe the one called Pride Humbled by him, the translator, but really the Ambata Sutta. I'm going to try to talk about these three today. So, thus have I heard. It's always how they begin, evam maya shrutam, which literally means, eva means thus, just so, or something like that. And maya means by me, and shrutam, it was heard. Ekasmin samaye, on a specific occasion. That's very important. Because, why? Because that phrase at the beginning of a sutta, or of a discourse, recording, a recorded discourse, which is what sutras are in Buddhism, indicates that the person who is repeating it was there when it was taught. So somebody I know wanted to translate once upon a time like it was a fairy tale, but that's not correct. It shouldn't ever be the case. And even have I heard is a little too vague. It means like I could have heard it like as a rumor or something, you know, that, oh, I heard about that. No, it should be, thus did I hear on a certain occasion. And the certain occasion, the once in this translation, is in the next sentence. But that's not, the once is not the fact that Buddha's living somewhere, although they've run together, but the once is, I heard it on once. I heard it at one time, at a certain time. Ekasmin samaye. The word for time is a special connection time. It means meeting time, something like that. Samaya means it's a little different from just kala. Ekakala, ekasmin kale would be just a certain time. And samaya can mean time, but it means like a time of meeting, a certain occasion. Okay? So, evam maya shrutam ekasmin samaye, thus have I heard, or thus did I hear on a certain occasion. That's how it should begin. Because the idea is that these really happen, and someone's really reporting them. And Ananda, this guy with the idiot savant who could remember everything, you could talk for 2 hours and he could repeat exactly everything you said. People do have that ability. A lot of them in these ancient times did have that ability, they say, and I believe them. So the Lord, or Bhagavan, that means Bhagavan, people tend to translate Lord, because it's like used later for God in Hinduism. But Bhagavan literally means one who has a share or has a fortune. So it actually means the lucky one. It's a little less weighty than Lord, you know. But, you know, it has a, later the Hindus use it for God, Bhagavan, you know, they go. But Bhaga means a share, a portion, luck, and some other meanings later we'll get into later in the course. But it's so Bhagavan, and Van is possessive, so one who has a good fortune, lucky person. And that was 19th century thing they used for Bhagavan. And what it did was, I think it made people in a more rigid, monotheistic social climate feel, well, this guy is some kind of atheist, but at least he's blessed. Hope Yahweh is the one doing it. Let's hope. Right? So, but it's nice, Blessed Lord. Blessed Lord, the Arahat, that means enlightened, and the fully enlightened Buddha knows, etc., sees and clearly distinguishes the different inclinations of beings. For here is the wanderer, Supiya, finding fault in all sorts of ways with the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. I'm sure you all know that these are called the three jewels, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And the definition of a Buddhist later on emerges is one who takes refuge in those three jewels and leaves religions, actually, and resorts to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. But what is also very important about it, and why it fits, I believe, with the secularist agenda of Buddha, like of His Holiness, is that of those three, the Buddha is just the teacher of the refuge. The Sangha is the community trying to live with it, live by it, and share it with you. And the Dhamma is what one really takes refuge in, which is not only the teaching about the nature of reality, which is like fundamentally a scientific teaching, eliciting wisdom on the part of the student, more importantly than faith, meaning knowledge, and the reality taught. So to take refuge in the Dhamma means to take refuge in reality, to can the old slogan in many societies that ignorance is bliss and you don't want to know too much about what's going on or you'll be miserable, more miserable, and that reality will make you miserable. And Buddha's whole thing is based on his discovery, what he thought it was a discovery, and subsequently Buddhists have thought so, that reality is all right. In fact, it's great, it's marvelous. Freedom from suffering, at the least, reality. And suffering all comes from not knowing that reality and living in an unreality. You follow? Really quite simple. I mean, not that we know for sure it's true. We can always question, but it's actually fairly simple. So that's the real one. So anyway, they're talking and they're disputing. Then the Lord, the Buddha, being aware of lucky Lord, monks were saying, went to the round pavilion and took his seat. And then he said, well, what are they talking about? And they said, well, we're talking about them. And then he does a wonderful thing, just like Dalai Lama, actually, which I like very much. You know, when these people have been screaming in the street at the Dalai Lama, and lately at me too, I'm so honored. He says, monks, if anyone should speak in disparagement of me, of the Dhamma, or of the Sangha, you should not be angry, resentful, or upset on that account. Like His Holiness telling the Tibetans, don't get mad at those people screaming. Freedom of speech, he just says. Don't be mad. If you were to be angry or displeased at such disparagement, that would only be a hindrance to you. For if others disparage me, the Dhamma, or the Sangha, and you are angry or displeased, can you recognize whether what they say is right or not? Now that's like the Dalai Lama and his neuroscientific friends and psychological friends who prove that when you lose your temper, your judgment diminishes, and you become unable to distinguish fact from thing, and you get a very narrow tunnel vision, and you charge ahead or whatever, you know. So Buddha's saying that right away. He says that you're not going to know whether you're not going to be able to think clearly once you get angry because they disparage me, and so you won't know. Maybe they have a point, or maybe they don't, but you won't be able to decide. Isn't that marvelous? It's just so Dalai Lama. It's just incredible. I just loved it. I never even noticed it reading this many times as I have in classes. So in other words, you have to keep cool, and if there's something they're saying wrongly, try to correct it. But then he says, but monks, if others should speak in praise of me and the Dhamma or the Sangha, you should not on that account be pleased or happy or elated. If you were to be pleased, happy, or elated at such praise, that would only be a hindrance to you. If you got all excited, oh, Buddha's so great. Then you again, if others praise me, the Dhamma or the Sangha, you should acknowledge the truth of what is true, saying that is correct, that is right, that is our way, that is found among us, but meaning you should understand it and make a good judgment about it. It is monks or mendicants for elementary inferior matters of moral practice that the worldling would praise the Tathagata. And I think I've told you all, Tathagata means one who has understood reality, actually. And that reality here is being called Tatata, which means suchness or thusness, but especially better is suchness. Because such is a very interesting way of speaking about something, because it means not quite what it is, but such as it is, you know. Such means like it. It's different from thatness. Another way of referring to reality is thatness. And thatness indicates that the absolute nirvana is in every bit of the relative. But the suchness indicates that every bit of the relative points beyond itself to the ultimate. So they have a slight different thing. And tatata means in gata, which is past passive participle of verb to go, is the word used in Sanskrit for understanding.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallahs. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part podcast was originally recorded during the ongoing Force for Good class series, now happening in person and online from Tibet House US in New York City. To learn more about this ongoing class, please visit tibethouse.us. As we heard in the first part of this week's episode, Bob gave a teaching on how the Buddha's own teachings themselves were secular in nature, and how the Force for Good class series recreates the secular presentation of these mind-transferring practices. If you're inspired by what you hear here, please be sure to check out Daniel Goleman's book by the same name, Force for Good. We link to it in the podcast description, and it's a great book to see how all the Dalai Lama's different initiatives across the years are being implemented by different engaged communities. There's also several recordings with Robert Thurman and Daniel Goleman from when they launched the Force for Good class series several years ago on the Tibet House US YouTube channel. The second half of this week's episode will be Bob opening up with a story from what it's like to attend Dalai Lama's teachings and a little bit about his notion of the Dalai Lama's style of teaching and the intrinsic naughtiness included within that style of teaching, which helps us engage our own personal ability to learn, study, contemplate, and meditate on the Buddha's teachings as they're passed down through the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. This week's episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast, as always, is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including access to all past Force for Good class series sessions with Robert Thurman and friends, please visit tibethouse.us. Membership includes discounts and special invites to fundraising events is special Dosset tours with Robert Thurman and friends with Geographic Expedition. To learn more about annual fundraising events like the December 10th annual Tibet House benefit auction happening in New York City, please visit Tibet House US. And to learn about Tibet House trips with Geographic Expeditions, please visit bobthurman.com. And if you're inspired, please be sure to share, like, and comment on all your favorite social media platforms. And as always, weekly interstitial music is provided by Tenzin Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzin Chogyal, visit his website at tenzinchogyal.com. And now, back to the second half of this week's episode with Bob and a poetry segment by Gary Gock.
You know, Dalai Lama can be very frustrating giving a public lecture, as some of you may have noticed if you have ever been there. I know a lot of people who've been to his lectures, and afterwards you say, how is it? And they say, oh, it's wonderful, because they like his field. They love the field of the Dalai Lama. But if they manage to stay awake throughout the entire time, they then say, but I had a lot of problems with this and that time. I couldn't quite understand, and maybe it was the translation and all this. But actually, His Holiness is very naughty in that he doesn't shy away from complications and complexities. And he'll go on and on about how that chair is not the leg, and it's not the seat, and it's not the back, and it's not the thing in the floor, and whatever. And it disappears under analysis. People are like, what, the chair disappeared, or what? They like, well, you know, he go on and around that sort of thing. But one of the reasons he does that is he's wanting people to realize they have to learn. The only thing that saves you from suffering, according to the Buddhist pedagogical, I'm not saying religious, pedagogical insight, is understanding the world. And therefore it's wisdom. Wisdom doesn't mean just being resigned to what's going on. It means knowing, and therefore the word for prajna, wisdom, may not be the right word. Intelligence and super intelligence might be the right word for prajna, actually. Pra means super, nya means to know. To super know is that what wisdom is? Maybe. To really know something, deeply, fully know it. That's what prajna really means. It's been set as wisdom since Edward Conza and before him. But is it just wisdom? I'm not sure. You know, when you have a deep experience of reality, where in a way you merge with it in some way, then, and not only that, but you are forewarned critically not to misinterpret that merger, something like that. So it's complicated. It's not just simplistically like you can just throw away all your ideas and somehow you become one with the flower. That is actually a great experience, that kind of thing. But by itself, then you remember it, then you interpret it a certain way. And then that's all, so the intelligence always there, actually. And so there's wisdom. Anyway, that's the word we used to use, wisdom. Or intuition, sometimes I like to use. Critical intuition or primal intuition. So wisdom, intuition, or intuitive wisdom born of learning. Intuitive wisdom born of critical reflection, debate and thinking and doubting and wondering about it yourself, thinking back and forth. And only then, wisdom born of meditation, can it be effective. So in the Buddhist tradition, like I went to my original root Buddhist teacher, I would say 53 years ago, and I said, you know, I want to attain enlightenment, I want to meditate. And he said, yeah, you can meditate later, now you can learn something. And that is the tradition, actually, all throughout Buddhist history. In the West, they've noted that Americans, Westerners, Europeans, Americans, modernized people, have learned too many things. They've been to graduate school, a lot of them. They've learned a lot of stuff. But what they learned did not necessarily lead them to nirvana or to attaining some sort of whatever. Maybe it gave them a profession, gave them some this and that, made them like become world weary. And so they're sort of thinking this learning stuff on some level is like, oh, it's just more headache, right? Yeah, I can do long division in my head, but that doesn't make me happier. That actually makes me unhappier when I divide my salary by my years of work and my pension when it's robbed by a corporate raider. And so they don't want to learn anything. Therefore, just sit and meditate, empty your mind. Then they get a buzz out of that. Because they have, for once, they're not thinking, and they get a temporary. But that, and then they, but then the danger is, then they're sort of they become stupefied in their learning process. They become unwilling to learn another thing. And the other cultural prejudice is there, that since we're the most modern, most advanced, most sophisticated, most scientific, and blah 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 culture, what really is there to learn from any pre-modern thing or person? Nothing. We know everything. Well, we sort of don't quite know. Exactly, we build nuclear power plants on top of geological faults in front of tsunamis, and so we don't really know what the heck we're doing, but we can do a lot of things that make big bangs and big explosions. Main thing being, so fascinating, the whole thing about former and future life are really here, and misunderstandings of former and future life are really important, but the reality of former and future life are the cause of the misunderstandings, in a way. So it's not logical to use these as a way of saying, oh, Buddha didn't really think there was a former and future life. No way. But actually, we should be taught as children to do mindfulness and how to manage our emotions in a certain way. That should be part of a decent education, which it isn't in our case. And because we are just part of a system where we're just supposed to follow orders. Still too much, you know. But it's not considered a big attainment. In fact, there are people today, not only Brian Weiss, but there's quite a few other people. You can find them at places like Omega and Kripalu and places like that, which are too few of those in this country and in Europe and Japan and so on. And then they can do what's regression. You can use, instead of deep level of mental concentration, you can be concentrated through hypnosis. Mild form of hypnosis, and then you will definitely remember former lives quite easily, a few of them. You know, I'm a hard case because I was brainwashed like a male chauvinist, waspy, whatever, you know, my education. So I had a hard time, even though I went to regression, even though I theoretically think it's absolutely rational and logical about being former lives, and there's a lot of evidence for it. But I finally did in my 60s, I remembered a few. My wife instantly regressed and remembered three or four good lifetimes. And which were very convincing to her. And someone can say, oh, well, you're just going in your unconscious, or they're trying out some theories now, somebody in England, that you're remembering the memories of your genes to try to keep Richard Dawkins in business. You know, they don't want to have that you personally were there somewhere. You know, it's you remembering your gene memory. And to get out, to explain the vast evidence there is of people remembering previous lives. And you just go, and what you do is you get a little bit of mindfulness, a little bit of ability to concentrate, and then you sit and you practice where you go back in this life, like you are 25 years old, and what were you doing this day, you know, January 13th when you were 15 years old? You do not remember that. You don't doubt that it happened. But you could do a meditation where you go and try to remember. And you might remember some outstanding experiences, and you keep working back, you know. People do that with shrinks, you know. They start remembering free associating because the knowledge, the memories are there. And then you do that meditatively, more powerfully than you can with a shrink, much faster. And then you sort of get a run-up, and then you go back and you find that other life, you know. You'll sort of see something and some landscape or some article of clothing or house or a face. Pretty easy. And the regression people are very good at helping you do that. There's a whole bunch of them. So just go and try it. See how you do. And it's very convincing when you do. And people who are theoretically stuck still wouldn't deal with it. Although I had a big debate with a really heavily theoretically stuck person once, and who happened to be of Irish background. And I said, if you were in a village where your grandparents lived, and you were at a bar and, you know, on a tourism thing and having a time, and then suddenly you said involuntarily after three Guinness stouts to your friend, well, what happened to the house over so-and-so place? They said, what do you mean? That was destroyed in 1920. And then you suddenly remember that you know there was a house somewhere. Then you walk over there and the next morning and you see there was a house there and who lived in it. And then you talk around and you find out the name you had was right. I said, all I asked that guy is, would you count that as evidence that you might have born there in a previous life? He refused to answer the question. He refused to say yes, but he also refused to say no. He wouldn't consider the question. It's like I always refer to the story of Yashas, you know, the Buddha's first lay disciple who was a yuppie. And there are different versions of the story, of course, in the Pali itself. And there's one version in the Pali where it's about Buddha himself in another life. But the best main story that people mostly accept in Buddhism is he's this yuppie. And he was out with his pals, with some girls, some courtesans, and then they were drugged and rolled. So their American Express cards were taken and their clothes and jewels, and all they had left was their dhoti, you know, like a jockstrap. And they were like bleary and hungover and running through the woods and then looking to get their property back, you know, to find these girls who had like mugged them, rolled them. And so like, did you see some girls? You know, they come into the Buddha's grove where he's sitting with the monks. And apparently he comes up to the Buddha and Buddha says, would you rather find your American Express card and some girls and some jewel tiaras, or would you prefer nirvana? And the guy looks at Buddha and goes, oh, nirvana, of course. So what I consider that is he collided with the mandala of the Buddha's presence. He felt a higher bliss emanating from the heart of the Buddha and in the field of the Buddha than any bliss he could remember from any of his partying. Somehow it got through to him and lifted him out of a hangover, a sense of outrage, a sense of greed, and they lifted him right out of that. And then he sat down and he heard the Four Noble Truths taught by Buddha. And then he got into contemplating that very intensely. Then his parents were worried about him and they came looking for him. And Buddha put a shield of invisibility around him so he could finish his meditating while he chatted with the parents. And then he realized Nirvana, that kid, right then and there. And then he removed a type of arhatship, let's call it, let's say, you know, some degree of it. And then he removed the screen, and then they said, oh, here's our son. And he said, fine. And the son said, wow, am I really fine? I'm super happy. And the parents somehow, maybe they had a second son or a girl, whatever, some nice daughter that they liked, they weren't that freaked out. Maybe he was too much of a party animal. They thought he was going to go straight. They were happy too, and they took refuge in the Buddha, and they said they would support the community and so on. So the his first lay disciple was Yashas, which came in that way. And so that to me is they enter the mandala of the Buddha's presence, you know. And then in many of these things, like even looking, the way he describes these different states, you're looking at a crystal smooth and like someone in a fantastic, he describes the blissfulness of it in a really marvelous manner. So, and he radiates that, obviously. And so many people come at him in different ways, and then they just completely calm down around him, you know. So that was my argument to the... So in other words, Buddha did say that to the monks at some point in another one of these discourses, Pali discourses, that I withheld nothing from you guys. I've taught everything, he said. But on the other hand, in the 45 years I've been teaching you, you know, what I've taught is like this handful of leaves in my hand. And the teachings of the Dharma of all the infinite numbers of Buddhas throughout the multiverse are like the leaves in all the trees in the forest around us, he said. But I see it in a different way historically. For example, the Mahayana teaching, which I consider to be part of Buddha's teaching from the beginning without question, personally, but yet it doesn't emerge as a well-publicized force in Indian society for about 400 years. And then there's a big argument among scholars, who of course they don't consider Buddha taught it, they think people made it up later. Because one thing about modern scholarship about Buddha is they think he's just another guy, you know, he's an Indian Socrates with an orange toga instead of a white one, like a Greek, you know. And he doesn't drink Ratsina, but otherwise, he's just like another guy, like one of their Oxford dons. You know, they don't imagine some really higher intelligence. They refuse. So they wouldn't see someone who could see causality in a society for hundreds of years or thousands of years. Even they wouldn't see that. So There's an argument, did the Mahayana rise in the south of India due to different social circumstances? Did it rise in the north? Did it rise in the east, in Bengal, because of different circumstances? Because there are many countries in India, right? It's a subcontinent. My theory is that it arose in all three places, because those were the fringes of what's called the Sanskritization process of India, where Brahmanism spread throughout India, even Tamil Nadu and all these other places, along with Sanskrit. And so, in other words, the Mahayana, which interferes more aggressively with the lay people's way of being. You see, these things here in the Pali, he's just saying, I don't have my mendicants do these things. Right? So that they don't serve the society as priests. They purely are seeking enlightenment. That's their role, and that's why they're tolerated. They become a kind of fourth. I do a diagram historically when I'm doing history. If you say that the marketplace of the Indian city-state, the dominant institution is the palace of the king. Then on this side is the next level are the Brahmins who have a temple. And they do all these services of naming and everything, and they live on the patronage of the king, which is actually why they are lower than the warrior class, the king class. Although the Brahmins themselves nowadays will say they are always the top. You know, they're constantly trying to say that kings are listening to them. But that's wishful thinking. That's like a tenured professor thinking that the trustees aren't going to listen to him when he says, don't do research on kill monkeys, you know, in psych labs and things. So that second thing is the temple over here. Then there's the marketplace over here. And those are the three dominant classes, the warrior ruling class, the intellectual priest class, and the merchant class. And then the fourth is open to the countryside. You know, and that's the peasants, the farmers. They bring the grain. They do the work, right? The working class. So Buddha planted there in the fourth side, though, but a little bit in the suburbs, seven stones throw away from the marketplace, in theory. He planted the monastery, you know, the vihara, which the Westerner monastery is not right, because it's not a place where you go to be alone. It's a place where these people who leave the home, the homeless people, stay in a grove at first or something. Then later they have houses a little bit because it rains on them at a certain time of year, etc. And people give them the grove, and then they build little huts in it, and then they become monasteries. But viharas is their quote, which just means an abode, you know. And then that fourth side of the thing, the reason they're close to the marketplace is that they go in every day to get lunch. And then in exchange for lunch, they give a talk. So they start changing the society, and the society tolerates this group of people who are not productive. The king doesn't dare to, like, defrock them. Even this warrior king, who is like a killer, you know, he doesn't dare do it. He says, I'd feed them if they came to my palace. The Brahmins are the ones most threatened by them because they're starting a new definition of holiness, and they are kind of relativizing the power of the gods ideologically. So they're the ones, you know, who would crucify them, in short, even Buddha, if they could have. And there you see his interaction in the third sutra with that Brahmin. The Brahmin's like, oh, who are you telling me this and that? Who are you? And it's like, really, the young Brahmin is very hot-headed with him, and he gets deeply humbled. You should read that sutta. It's quite vigorous. But the key there was, don't at least bother their livelihood. Let them keep their livelihood. Don't do anything. Don't show any kind of clairvoyances or things to people. Just you're there, they're feeding you, and you're changing the society slowly by creating a different vision of life and sharing it with them bit by bit. And don't go in and tell them, oh, you shouldn't do animal sacrifice in your temple, for example, which they were doing in those days. They were not like vegetarian. And don't tell these ones, don't be crooked in your business. And don't tell the king, don't make war on this and that person, although he generally tells them that's not a good idea. But don't go and interfere with the warriors. You're just seeking another level, right? And then that does influence. And then when the influence of that becomes really strong, then it's safe to bring out the big guns, which are the Mahayana sutras, the Mahayana discourses. Like even in you're a layman, even you're a Brahmin, you should change your life. Even you're living in the household, you should start meditating at home and change the way you treat your wife and your daughter.
The This poem is entitled Kindness by Naomi Shaheeb Nye. Roger Houston writes of Naomi Shaheeb Nye that she was born of a Palestinian father and an American mother. Her work consistently reveals the poignancy and paradoxes that emerge from feeling an intimate relation with two different cultures. Raised in St. Louis, Missouri, she has lived in Jerusalem and now resides with her family in San Antonio, Texas. Her poems and short stories have appeared in reviews and magazines all over the world. Besides her 6 volumes of poetry, she has also written books for children and edited several anthologies of prose. She first started writing poetry at the age of 6. She says, "Somehow I knew what a poem was. I liked the comfortable, portable shape of poems, and especially the way they took you to a deeper, quieter place almost immediately." Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop, the passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow. Friend. I'm Gary Gawk, and this segment is a part of the Bob Thurman Podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa, under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal. Tashi Delek.